Hey, what's going on? Welcome to The Doug Show. I'm Doug Cunnington, and today I'm chatting with Ben Boze. Ben is a software developer, and he's the founder of Tech Lockdown and the co-founder of Living Room. He was frustrated by easily bypassed consumer screen time tools, so he adapted enterprise-grade cybersecurity and mobile device management architectures to solve personal digital addiction and focus challenges. One of those deals where he basically solved his own problem and realized there were other people with the same problem out there. So Ben, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Hey, thanks for having me on, Doug. I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Really awesome. And what I invited you to the studio and you were willing to make the drive. We live in the same metro area, but it's far enough away. And I was like, you know what? I don't want you to sit in traffic. So I'm glad we were able to work it out. And maybe next time you join in the studio, we could figure out a way to, you know, make it work. Like I said, I hate traffic myself. So I'm an old man now. So I'm like complaining about traffic all the time. So one thing I want to jump into here is where your business is now, currently, kind of in the middle of the story. So we're recording this in September of 2026. And can you tell us a little bit about maybe, you know, what's the one line summary of your company? And then, you know, maybe revenue numbers, margins, churn, all the gory details. I know you can't share everything, but as much as you're comfortable, just to give people the idea of the scope of your business.
Yeah. So like you said, I'm the founder of Tech Lockdown, and I co-founded an app that I launched a year ago. Tech Lockdown is my bread and butter right now. It's how I'm paying the bills. It's me and a contractor who helps with support. The MRR for the business is over 20K at this point. So I'm able to pay myself a salary and focus on it full time instead of juggling it alongside, you know, like a full-time job, which I'm sure you're quite familiar with, you know, how these things typically go. The traffic numbers are still hovering around 50,000 visitors a month to the Tech Lockdown website, but I've experienced a lot of volatility with AI search summaries and Google's recent algorithm change that they made like a week ago. But that company is still in great shape. It's been growing. I have some exciting things I'm releasing for it. And yeah, the concept, like you said, it's basically like if you were, you're getting access to cybersecurity tools for personal use or for your family that are set up to like be something you can't get around because an enterprise uses stuff that can't be bypassed, right? And then the Living Room app, the more recent thing, that has been doing great, and it's been steadily growing. Partnered with another software developer to work on that project. It's currently, we just hit 4,500 MRR on that, which was a decent milestone. And the audience for this one is a little bit different. We're targeting parents who are trying to basically set up an iPad for a kid, and it's like totally safe. So it like records the screen when the kid's using the device, and so you know exactly what they're doing. So like I always think about if I had to give something to an 8-year-old, I want to be sitting right next to him and I want to feel like I know exactly what he's doing with it. So I thought that concept was a little bit too niche. But I'm surprised that like I've been able to find customers for it and it seems to have a really promising future.
Cool. Congrats. Very, very amazing. And we'll get into your origin story. We're going to talk about, you know, how you grew the business originally, which is kind of the standard content website story, which is kind of interesting. We'll also get into some YouTube strategies and your experience there. And yeah, tons of details. But one thing I'll press you just a little bit and you can, I'll make it easy, but is it safe to assume because it's a SaaS product that the margins are, we'll just say very good?
Yeah, they're okay. Very good. Yeah, okay. Like I'm not, my fixed costs are a little bit higher now because I started renting an office just because I've got a toddler at home and it was a little bit too much working from home.
Okay.
So that's probably my highest fixed cost is like a private office that I'm renting right now.
Gotcha. And I'm just curious, how much does that cost? Because like, again, we're in the same metro area and there's like obviously different levels of quality of the place or how noisy or quiet or co-working versus like a private room. So yeah, how much is your office?
So I'm paying $750 a month for a pretty big office with like windows. I was fine with living in a closet, honestly. Like I tried to rent an office, like something that was basically the size of a closet for $300. But yeah. Then the only thing they had open was this one room. The quote I got from like a co-working space was like $1,400 for like a cubicle, you know, a glass cubicle. Like I was a little bit surprised. And I'm past the point where I need the whole, kombucha on tap situation. I just want to get in and grind, you know?
Right. You could buy a shitload of that at Costco for way cheaper. So
totally.
Yeah. Anyway. Okay, cool. So again, congrats on the business and thanks for letting me press you on that. When we were chatting earlier, you mentioned that you've been basically an entrepreneur since you were a kid. Do you have any like stories from when you were in high school or something, trying to get some stuff going?
Yeah, I think probably the first thing that sticks out to me was, I think I was like 14 or 15 and I was really big into Legos when I was a kid. And so I was just like, hey, I'm done with Legos now. Like, let me just like get this stuff out of my room. So I'll sell it on eBay. And just from the research of like, cause you have to research your listing, right? Like what do other people sell this thing for? How do they present it? What are the things that are successful? So I got really into eBay and I started noticing like there's all these unoptimized listings that have these gems in them, like it's underpriced. And there's these bulk listings where the people don't know that if you packaged it differently, you could make like double your money instead of just selling bulk. So I sold my Legos and then I started buying them and reselling them. And like I made like $1,000 in profit over a summer, which was like pretty big deal for me at the time, like 14 years old or 15 or whatever. And just kind of screwing around and like it just like scratched an itch. Like I was excited when I bought something that I could resell and just like trolling through listings to see which ones were not optimized that I could basically repackage. Not a sustainable business, obviously, like maybe some people could do it, but I just like the arbitrage concept to me started to make more sense at a young age. I think that's cool. Probably my earliest memory right there.
Were your parents like, why are you getting so many packages and have to send so much? I mean, it's like, you're basically doing that, right?
Yeah, I was like always ordering stuff. And my mom was, she got a kick out of it. I think she knew from a young age that I was going to do that kind of thing. But I think the funniest thing that I did was I bought like a mini, they're called minifigures, is like the little Lego men. And I was like, huh, people seem to like these specialty items. I wonder if I can just like get this helmet and paint it black and like cut off part of it and call it a specialty item. I sold this thing for like $25 and it blew my mind. Just blew my mind. And I don't know what my mom really thought about that. Maybe she wasn't monitoring too closely.
That seems, I mean, you're adding value. Like it was a specific need in air quotes for somebody. I never got into Legos too much.
Good
respect. Yeah. Respect. I mean, people are into it. One of my friends, he has a toddler and his son's like super into it. And he was like, oh yeah, when I grew up, I had like so many, I had a handful, but I think I don't even remember like actually putting together much of anything. It was all just like a little mess, but anyway, that's all good. So you had some, you know, fun buying, selling, arbitrage, pretty fun. You go to school, I take it you go to college, probably software or something. Yeah. Or other corporate world. Give us a little synopsis of that time frame and then we'll launch into the business. You can compress it a lot. I don't know how many years you were in the corporate world, but what's the story there?
Yeah. So college was a bumpy ride for me because I started out at one school, I transferred. I at one point, I really didn't want to be in college. I was studying business. That's my degree. It's business management, and which is maybe a little bit surprising, but college was just not clicking for me. It wasn't the environment that I really enjoyed. I got stressed when I couldn't work on other things. And so I ended up shifting to a school where I could like work at the same time, because I was in like West Virginia somewhere, in this place where like the only thing you could do is maybe work at Walmart. And I just like couldn't do that. So I remember being up late at night in like the library, like working on business ideas, because in the back of my mind, I needed to escape college and escape that like cookie cutter path, I guess. It just didn't work well for me. So I was in the DC area, and I got an internship at an IT staffing company. And I still don't even know what that means. I don't understand what they did. I don't get the value they added. I think the whole thing was a scam, to be honest.
Sounds right.
Yeah, it just was like, they were throwing around all this terminology that made no sense. And I guess what I realized is, in that experience, I really did not like the traditional corporate path. I thought it looked like a life I didn't want to live. And so I spent a lot of time, even while working this internship and going to school, figuring out like, how do I not do this with my life? Like this does not seem like a good life to me. So I started doing, I had taught myself how to build websites, and I was getting more into technical things. And I realized that people would pay you to like do that for them, but without hiring you as an employee. So it's called freelancing, as you know. But yeah, I was a freelance web developer for a while in college. And I remember getting a contract where they were paying me like $35 an hour, something like that. And it was just a mind-blowing amount of money for me at the time. And I started to realize like, wait a minute, like it is way better for me to do technical things than, you know, just go sit in a cubicle somewhere. And people really like stuff with leverage. And software has leverage to it. And this is like the best way to do business. So I just spent, I was obsessive with like learning programming, building projects. Then I started, I built like a tool to help me find clients, basically through Craigslist and these open source feeds. And then at the school I was going to, my professor in entrepreneurship saw some of the stuff I was doing. And he told me I should apply to their incubator program. So I pulled an all-nighter and applied because the deadline was the next day. And I was like one of six people that got into this thing. And, you know, for the next like year or so, I got to work on this like lead generating tool. They gave me like a very small stipend, and they gave me like two teammates that didn't give a crap about it. But sorry if they're watching this, but they really, it was my dream, right? It wasn't their dream. Ultimately, that didn't work out, but I ended up being a freelancer for like the next three to four years and doing that full time. And yeah, so like I was in college, but let's just say I wasn't in college mentally.
Right. Gotcha. Did you eventually finish and get your degree or?
Yeah, I got it. I got the degree, and it was honestly a pretty easy degree. So I skipped most of my classes, and if I went to class, I was like working on client work in the class.
Got it.
And so the funny thing is, I went to graduate, and one of the professors had no idea who I was and asked me like if I was in the wrong place. And I was like, oh yeah, I was in your class. I just went on the first day, and I never showed up again.
Which is, that's like my stress dream. It's like, do you have these stress dreams? You go to the first day of class, and then, you know, I'm like, oh, well, I got this final, and I show up. I'm like, I think I went. I'm like, oh, fuck, I didn't go to any of the classes. And that's a recurring dream. It's a very common one, I guess. By the way, I don't give a shit about the degree. Congrats. But I assume like, I know probably for my family, it was like, there's some family expectation. It's like the parents really want you to go and get it. But looking back now, I'm like, probably could have skipped it. I took like 6.5 years. Similar to you, where it was a co-op program. I worked like every other term kind of thing to pay for it. But anyway, during the
What was your degree in?
It was computer engineering. So actually I did a lot of coding and software and hardware stuff, and then like never used it in an actual job.
That's awesome. Good for you, man. That's really hard.
Never used it. Yeah. Thanks. It was extremely hard. I did not love it. And to your point, there were, multiple times, like every 18 months, I'm like, should I quit or find another degree? Like, this is extremely hard. And because I was working I was like, this seems like a really horrible existence. And I think, what year, were you doing the freelancing and in college? What range?
It might've been 2017.
Okay.
2015 to 17, I think. And then I started like a web agency and took my clients and merged with another freelancer.
Okay. And I was just trying to gauge, but are you a fan of Office Space? Do you know the movie Office Space?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I've tried to get my wife into that. We've watched it twice and I've gotten a chuckle out of her, but
what? Oh man,
not like a full on hearty laugh yet. I'm working
it's,
on it.
You know, it wasn't loved immediately, but I saw it I was interning at the time in like 99 when it came out. And I was like, it's kind of funny. I love it more now, but I was like, oh no, like this is exactly the path that I'm walking down. So I need to keep that in mind. And anyway, yeah. And I obviously, before your time, it came out like when you were a toddler or something like that, but it's, it holds true. Yeah. Keep watching it. It gets better and better. okay. As we're moving forward. So you were getting into web design and building websites, and you got it. I mean, naturally that leads to SEO. So tell me your experience with SEO. I mean, this is like the prime time, like when I was building websites and stuff like that, 2015, to 2020 timeframe. So what's going on with you? Are you learning the content engine and just SEO in general?
Yeah, I mean, I was, I did a bunch of projects that were web-based and none of them worked out, but I was always looking at learning about long tail keywords. And I remember there was this tool, I think it was literally called Long Tail Pro or something. Yep. Do you remember that?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Spencer Hawes.
And like tool. Screaming yep. Frog and all that.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Yeah. Those were the tools of the time. And I remember the long tail stuff made a lot of sense to me because I was thinking like, okay, I could have a 0% chance of ranking for something that has a lot of traffic, or I could have like 20% chance of getting on page one for something that's really specific. And that worked. Like I remember making a hobby website because I played like video games at one point and I was recording myself playing the games. And I was like, I bet there's people that want to know how you do this. And so I packaged up a website that was literally called Record on PC, like pretty typical government name for a product. and I just started publishing this content and I got like a trickle of traffic to it, and it was really exciting to me. Just the fact that I could make something and just put it out there and someone could find it. And I did the long tail approach early on because there was this big thing about your domain rating. And if you're not up to this certain point, like don't even try. and then I tried to do the backlink thing for a while and I just never, I forget who it was. It was like Backlinko. Neil Patel. Do you know who that is?
Yeah. Neil Patel. He had, Backlinko was Brian Dean.
You're right.
And then, Neil Patel, it was like something Sprout or I can't remember. Go ahead.
Then. Yeah. I just Backlinko. Know he sold it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I read a lot of, Brian Dean stuff and it was a lot of like, how do you get backlinks and, the thing that did stick out to me was you should make content that people want to share because it's helpful, like genuinely helpful. So So don't just like make something that you wouldn't read and follow yourself. So I started putting a lot more effort into making something. And then when I would share it, I would feel like not embarrassed about sharing it. You know, if I posted on Reddit and I linked to it, I would think to myself, like, I've given away so much for free here. These people can't possibly be mad if I reference it because it's just a free thing. Like, how could you hate that? And it did work. Like, I started getting, and especially for my more recent projects, people want to solve problems. And there's this thing called reciprocity, where if you give someone something, they kind of owe you something subconsciously. So they're more likely to like say yes to other things that you ask them for, or be more likely to share something. So that really stuck out to me. I don't know if I would have thought about that if I hadn't read Brian Dean's stuff. And also, because there was this big thing about making skyscraper content and making things that people would share and like infographics and stuff. I never did any of that, but I got the point, which was like make useful things. Don't just like throw out fluff that isn't helpful to anybody and expect them to like want to help you out by giving you a backlink.
Right. Yeah. And it, I want to say like things started to get, as they do, more saturated. Marketers ruin everything. Like when things start working, then they're like, all right, let's scale this. And then there were more tools coming out to help people do this in an automated way. And now it's just off the charts. I mean, the number of emails that I get for, hey, listen to the last show. Really love how you and Ben talked about the challenges of entrepreneurship. I'm like, fuck you. You never listened to the show.
I know.
Get out of here. So, and there's, I mean, I feel a little bit bad for the actual employee, like the podcast promotion, low-level employee. I'm like, I mean, I want to write back something mean, but they're just doing their job, you know. Anyway,
right.
So you never got into the link building game, but you were just trying to be helpful. And tell us like about, so actually what year are we roughly? Cause trying to draw a timeline, and you did get laid off. Like we do share that in our history, where we were working on side hustles, had some experience, and then lost our corporate jobs. And then we had a decision to make, but yeah, where are we in the timeline here roughly?
We're probably like 2015, 2016, okay. Where I really started to get the handle on SEO. I'm freelancing. So I was selling like web design, web development services. I was setting up email for people. Like I worked for this, I was a contractor for a nonprofit, and they're just like, hey, our email's terrible. And I was like, okay, I'll migrate you over to Google Workspace and do all that. And I just got a kick out of like, I can do all this stuff with technology now and people need this, and they'll pay me like $55 an hour sometimes for stuff that I couldn't get paid $55 an hour in my career path. Like it just wasn't a thing at that time. And obviously I wasn't working 40 hours a week and getting that all the time, but I started to see like what people valued, and I was reading a lot about value-based pricing. I forget the exact like thread that I'm pulling on here, and sorry if this is a little bit off topic, but this is one thing I did realize when I was freelancing is if I say that I'm selling something valuable to someone and I charge too little, they won't believe me. And what they're paying for is the outcome, not necessarily the hours that go into it. So I changed around how I was pricing things, and I stopped selling hours in a lot of cases, and I started selling like very constrained scope of work tied to like a fixed price. And I remember selling, I sold like an e-commerce site for like $8,000. And it was just, I'd never sold anything for that amount of money before. And it was like a Shopify site. And it was really, I realized that the person I sold it to thought it was too cheap still. And conceptually I was like, $8,000 is a lot of money for a Shopify site. But I realized like they want the problem solved, and that I was giving them the confidence that I could do it. And at the same time, they would want things like SEO. And the fact that I knew SEO and I could say like, hey, these pages are pretty whack, man. Like the URL is like an ID, you know, like make, let's go to slugs. Let's change the permalink structure to slugs. Let's like do some really basic optimization here. There's no meta tags on the page, just like really basic stuff. But to the non-technical crowd, this is like speaking a totally different language. And what they're hearing is, I have a chance of getting customers by this like technical thing you're doing. So this is around like, you know, between 2015 and 2017. And then I started an agency with a colleague that I was, another like a designer who we would work together. He would get me to do development and I would get him to do design on projects. And we realized like it would be better to just team up because I'm doing value-based pricing on you and you're doing it on me. So let's just like do it at the same time so we don't have to like play this game every time.
Right.
And that was like a 2.5 year stint.
Cool. All this on the side, right?
Well, this is actually full time.
So okay,
I went from like senior year in college doing freelancing to out the door, I'm doing it full time, and then going into co-founding an agency, basically doing that full time.
Got it. Okay, cool. And classic, a great value-based discussion there. Classic example is like the locksmith. You lock yourself out of the car and they walk up, they get you in there in 30 seconds and you have to pay like $300 or $400. And it's because of the outcome, not how long it takes. Because, I mean, you would have been stuck, locked out of your car for hours or whatever. Or you would.
Sure.
Yeah. So value-based. And yeah, great way to reframe it. And then you're like, oh, I'm not an hourly person. Like I am giving you this solution. Like here's the new world once we solve your problem. So, okay, great. You do this for a few years. Let's fast forward to in the COVID timeframe. So what happened then? Tell me about your job situation. And this is the origin of, you know, solving your own problem here, right?
Yeah. So The agency I co-founded, we did that for like 2.5 years. It ultimately didn't work out. The partner accepted a job from one of our customers and like got a really good job out of it. And then I had to go back to the job market. And at this point, I've never had like a big boy job. Like, you know, I've had an internship before this, but I've just been working for myself. So I'm doing the interviews. I'm not even sure what to go into. Like, should I do marketing? Should I do software? Should I do consulting? So I was like interviewing at all these places. And I eventually got a job at a cybersecurity company as a developer in their web department. So like all the web marketing stuff, I was one of three developers on their team. And this was like just seeing another world, going from like working crazy hours for yourself, working for like 10 different people, trying to make payroll, to like cushy job at a cybersecurity company where they cater your food. Your expectations are like, I have 2 weeks to do this. You know, like it was just wild to me. So I went in and just immediately started killing it. I was like, this is poorly done. Like, we're going to fix this. I did well at this company. I got moved to their product team. I got promoted to a senior title. I was put in charge of projects. And also, I was very unhappy. Like, I was kind of like telling my wife all the time, like, yeah, things are going great. I don't want to do this for the rest of my life. And I don't want to do this even for like another 5 years. Like, I got to get out of this.
Why was it so draining?
It wasn't draining, and I liked leading projects and stuff, but I think it's in the back of my mind, it's the knowledge that I could build something for myself and capture the full upside of that, and the downside, obviously. But you work for someone else, even when you're getting paid a salary, I'm just never happy with that, because I want to not have someone to tell me that I have to join this meeting at this date and time, and that I have to like fill out these like quarterly reviews and play the corporate game and join these like waste of time meetings. So it just isn't, it's money is like, I feel really privileged even saying this stuff out loud right now and I'm realizing how it sounds, but just intuitively, I know like this is not how I'm supposed to live my life. I should be doing something else. And so I would always like, you know, I would work a lot, long hours, but then on the weekends and like nights and early mornings, I would work on other ideas that I had with like the hope that maybe one day I wouldn't have to work for someone else.
Gotcha. Yeah, it totally makes sense. There's a lot of waste in the bigger systems. And it does, I ended up in middle management. So if you end up there, then you can actually like be super lazy. And there's a lot of waste in the system. Like you said, you showed up and you're like, I have 2 weeks to do this thing that
right.
takes like a day and a half. Because of whatever, the meetings and the planning and the other, again, just admin and overhead that's all the waste in the system, which is, I mean, it's necessary. But if you could peel that away, then you're like, oh, wow, the margins are way higher working for yourself, doing the exact same work, like a sickening amount, like 2x or something like that. So anyway, all right, so you're working there for a little while, doing well, you get promoted. What's going on next?
Well, I'm in, we're in the 2020 timeframe. I'm working remotely partially, and then I'm in office for the, you know, one day a week at this place, and COVID happens. And there was that like 3 week period where they locked everything down and like you couldn't leave your house or someone would yell at you. And at that time I started to realize like, okay, I'm like alone in this apartment getting like way too much internet time. And you have the stress of like COVID at the same time. So I was just realizing I was starting to form an unhealthy relationship with my devices and, you know, realizing that I need to like take this very seriously and set up some guardrails around how I'm using, you know, my devices to break some bad habits. And I was really big into reading, books about habits. I was like doing powerlifting and competing in some sports on the side. So you have to be very habit focused to even make that successful. And so I was always reading those kinds of books. So I realized like, okay, for this problem, I just need to make it so that there's a lot of friction between me and like a bad habit so that it stops becoming automatic. So, but since I'm a software developer, I know that the bar for that's pretty high. For technology. So I went, you know, I drew on my experience in cybersecurity and was like, okay, I'll set up things the way an enterprise would when they have a lot of money on the line and they can't have an employee doing anything shady on their device. So I set that system up and I realized this has solved the problem for me. Like I'm loving this. Like I can be working in my apartment and not feel like I'm around like a box of donuts, you know, like all the time. If that's even a problem. I mean, some people don't care about donuts, but it's a problem for me sometimes.
Yeah. I'll eat them all.
yeah. So like I came up with my own system and realized, all right, if I have this problem, there's like a ton of people having this problem. So I made a YouTube video and a Reddit post about it. And I logged my whole system. I had like it's probably the most boring YouTube video of all time, but I think 300,000 people have watched it at this point. Oh, wow. But I was getting all these comments from people that were like, this is great. This has been a huge problem for me. And then people asking to pay me to like set things up for them. And so that's the light bulb moment. Like, okay, there is something here and it's something I'm kind of interested in. So, I started blogging about it a bit more on like the Medium platform. And I would make YouTube videos and I'd promote them on Reddit. But I didn't sell anything. And it was like a side project because my full-time job was like pretty intense. Like I was put in charge of like two projects every quarter that I'd have to deliver on a weekly basis, like an update to the whole engineering team. So I couldn't slack at all. So this was like early, early morning and weekends when I was doing this. But yeah, that's kind of when I realized, like, I think there's something here.
Gotcha. And then it was through the Reddit post, your blogging and YouTube that you had, like, the initial audience. Can you talk a little bit about that approach just generally?
Yeah. So the YouTube video, it got like 10,000 views pretty quickly, which was like, I haven't had anything do that before really. And the Reddit post went on the front page and it stayed there for a while. And I was just getting a lot of interactions from people, which is a good sign that there's reciprocity involved when people are taking time to even comment. And from there, I just started publishing on Medium because I didn't have time to like throw up a website and all that stuff. And people started, I started seeing the metrics on Medium and realizing this stuff's actually ranking on Google now, and partially because I'm driving traffic from Reddit and from YouTube. So I think there's some algorithm thing happening behind the scenes where it's seeing the social traction and prioritizing me on search engines.
Got it.
Yeah, that was the story.
And then, the thing is, like, you didn't have any ulterior motives at the time. Not that selling something is an issue, because like you have to have a reason to do whatever it is you're doing. But you were like, I'm sharing this information, and it was actually helpful. You were realizing like, oh wait, people are offering me money. So how did you transition that into some revenue?
Yeah, I realized like I would have to come up with something that allowed myself to scale, because I can't be doing, you know, meetings or whatever alongside my job. And I had no interest in doing like consulting for people for that problem, because it doesn't work remotely to do that kind of thing. Yeah. So I decided the best way to do it was to fund myself doing research and writing these things. And the best way to fund myself would be to do paid content, which you're obviously familiar with because you've been in the course world before. So I built a website and I put up all my free content there. I redirected it. And then I had like, here's the premium portal. If you want like set up for each device step by step, instead of going through 50 of my articles and piecing it together, pay for this membership and then you get access to it. And that was how I'd interact with people. And then some people would email me and I would kind of point them to the guides, but I wouldn't spend a lot of time like doing consulting over email.
Okay. And obviously, one issue with this, how did you do the pricing? How did you charge? I was going to say, you know, that time frame, I think maybe online courses weren't as popular. People were like, let's do memberships or communities or whatever kind of stuff the kids are into these days. But obviously, once people get this shit set up, they don't need to keep paying you. It's like the problem solved. Like they're done and they're out the door, right? So how'd you set it up initially?
Yeah, well, that would have been the smart thing to think about from the beginning. But I went straight into like, here's a subscription that's monthly, and hopefully you'll stick around for more than 1 month. And after you've read the material and implemented it, and so, yeah, I it was like $7 a month. It was like a very small membership fee. And so I didn't make much money off of this within the first year, but I was just kind of thinking of the MVP approach where, you know, you try to get something very focused out that helps you prove traction. Like, will someone give me $1 for this? Will it, you know, is this valuable to anybody? And then you layer on from there. So I wasn't too concerned with like, I need this thing to be super profitable. And I understood it's flawed to have like, to expect someone to subscribe for 12 months. But I had like the roadmap in mind of like, there's going to be paid content, but then I'm going to bundle in something that I'm already selling, like telling people about and just making it part of that subscription. So they'll get this paid content, but the main reason they'll stay around is to stick with that service that I'm recommending.
Gotcha. Okay. Cool. And then you got laid off.
Yeah. So this, fast forward to like 23. This was 2023 or 2022. I'm at the cybersecurity company, very burnt out. Having lots of, you know, issues at home as a result, and just realizing, you know, I really want to go do my own thing. But I'm not quite there financially. And I'm preaching to the choir here because you're into like financial independence and stuff. I wasn't financially independent enough to be able to like lose my full-time job and do it full-time. And I don't even think it was making $2,000 a month at the time. It was like lower than that. So I realized I needed a little bit more time for the side project to be able to pay for like my expenses. And so I basically took a job offer for a demotion at another company for a very easy job, switching from like a very promising career path where I just gotten promoted again. And you can imagine the conversation with my wife was like, yeah, I just got promoted. Also, I'm going to take a demotion with the hope that someday I can leave that job kind of quickly and do my own thing. And she actually was like very much on board with it, which was surprising to me. But so I left the cybersecurity company, killed my career, right? Just like cut the head off right then, switched to this very easy job, which was surprisingly paying pretty well. And then I had a lot more energy to like, in my free time, I could do, you know, work on the side project that I really wanted to work on. And I wasn't as drained mentally, because even if, you know, you're doing something from 9 to 5, if it's intense 9 to 5, you don't have the energy in the morning or at night or on the weekend. You need that time to like recuperate, right? So this other job was, you know, it's a typical 9 to 5, but it was like, I didn't have to think as hard, basically. So I did that job, I think it was 4 or 5 months, and then the company laid off like 10% of the workforce, and I was, you know, last in, first out, basically.
Okay. Yeah.
But also, I was like, this totally makes sense. Like, I would have laid me off too. You guys hired me into this team that didn't need anybody. I've got nothing to do. And this work is not hard. And you're paying way too much because the hiring bubble. So I totally understood the decision. And then I basically just decided like, all right, I'm going to focus on my side project full time and see if I can grow it. But I'm also going to look for another job at the same time because I don't really believe I can do it.
Gotcha. So interesting. So when you psychologically, you understood why you were getting laid off. How'd you feel? Were you like, this is devastating? Or you're like, okay, now I have a chance and I didn't have to quit to try and do it full time. Like someone gave me a little push.
Yeah. I mean, well, let me know if this matches your experience, but it was a mixture of like being stunned. You know, you get the email and you're locked out of everything. You're like, whoa, I've never had this happen before. And then excitement, like it's a mixture of fear and excitement almost. And then going through this like back and forth of like, how am I going to pay bills? What if I can't get another job? What if my side project fails? Was it kind of like that in your situation?
A great description. Yeah. I was like, similar, although I didn't go to another job. I just got laid off from a company that I worked at for about 9 years. But yeah, I was just like, this has been kind of a drag. Totally makes sense. And I was like, all right, now I have a chance. And I didn't even have to like quit on my own. So yeah, it was pretty good. I mean, I was like pretty excited like right away.
But did you already have like in the back of your mind, like, okay, if I get laid off, here's what I'm going to do. Did you ever have that going in parallel?
I think so, but I wasn't sure. So this was about 2015 and I had a month or two of success over the last 2 years. So it was like a roller coaster ride. So I would make like full-time income for like a month or two, and then it would like drop off. So think just algorithm updates or Amazon affiliate commission rate changes or something like that. So just all of a sudden external forces like really kill the revenue. And I knew some things that could work, but I wasn't sure what. So like you said, at some point someone was like, hey, can you build a website? And I was like, I know how to do that. So I tried a few different things all at the same time before I arrived at like, this is the kind of work that I want to do that like suits my personality well. Extremely similar in that when I got laid off, I think I was maybe making like $1,500 a month. So really cool on the side, not close to like full-time income though.
Right. Yeah, I totally get that. And I think in my case, we had just bought, we had just closed on a house.
Oh, dang.
We were planning to have our first kid. And I didn't really want to like slow down the timeline. So I basically just put as many stressors on my plate as possible. And I interviewed at places after this too, because you have to be responsible. And I think the hardest thing happened, it was a few months after this, I got a job offer that was more than I was making before. And I remember thinking to myself, if I take this thing, I'm about to have a kid, I will never have this opportunity again. Like I will never be able to do this. And I think my wife actually convinced me to basically not take it, and that we would basically be very careful with spending money. So I don't know if I would have done it, because I would have felt too much responsibility with a kid on the way, and like paying for a mortgage and all that. So
yeah,
a lot of credit to my wife for any of this stuff working out, honestly.
Yeah, really. 100%. Yeah, because my wife was not into it. And even when I basically stopped working, I think she was still like shocked that it ever worked out at all. And I like worked for myself for like a decade, which is, it's pretty funny. But yeah, yeah.
Well, she's kind of rational.
Yeah, it is. She's like, she's just way more conservative and better with money too. But like from an entrepreneur standpoint, it's like, you don't have all the information. You have to make decisions and you don't know if it's going to work. You could set things up to reduce risk and downside. And I think that's probably the way to go. Great that your wife was like, go ahead, give it a shot. It makes sense.
Well,
okay,
go ahead. Have you found that your intuition has, like your gut feel for things, has that gotten better, especially now that you've had more time under your belt?
I think so. I haven't been doing a lot of, creating or building things recently. So I think maybe my intuition's worse, because now, as an older, hopefully wiser person, I think I got really lucky with timing. And I'm like, I don't know if I could do anything again. It's one of those, the Dunning-Kruger effect, where I'm like, I know a lot and I'm like an expert in several things. So I feel like I don't know anything because I know a lot about certain things. So I'm like, oh yeah, I think my intuition is probably worse than it used to be. Cause I think personally, I'm just like, I don't think I could do a lot of the stuff that I should probably be able to do. I don't know.
Yeah, it's funny. Have you ever watched Shark Tank?
No, I never. Funny enough, I never have.
If you want, Shark Tank was very helpful, because there are all these people that go up and they pitch on the stage to these billionaires and millionaires, and they'll go up and be like, my name is Don, and I made this like fur toy for puppies, and I make $600,000 a year, and I'm just trying to grow it. And you're like, and I'm working out of my basement, and like I still hand mail everything. And you're sitting there going like, what are you talking about? Like, you're not making money doing that. Like you're lying or something. And in the back, also with that, you realize that, some people, it's just like putting one foot in front of the other, and you learn from your mistakes and you make it work. But then as you get older and wiser, you know about all the things that can go wrong. So your intuition is like, you're going to get crushed by Walmart, dude. Like, don't even do that. Like, why would you even bother? Just like, oh, here's an idea. Let me go do it.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. I mean, it is one of those magical combinations where you have to be like naive enough to try it, but like smart enough to like execute. And like the intersection is like where some cool stuff happens. So Right. Okay, so I do see we're going a little bit long, so I'm going to fast forward on the story just a little bit here. A couple of things I want to ask you about. So when we may have to put placeholders and other stuff to catch up some other time in the future, but when you were developing the tool and the strategy and that sort of thing, AI coding was not as big. And I think now whenever there's a successful product, there's always copycats or people trying to come into that market because they see that it's profitable. And I'm curious how AI coding and people trying to just like copy successful products, where I'm sure, the strategies are probably like, go out and find products that look like they're selling money. Try to reverse engineer them. I'm sure there are YouTube channels and people just trying to teach that. So what have you seen over the last, 2 years when AI coding has become really powerful?
Yeah. Like when I started out, I was hand coding everything. I was having to be really thoughtful with architecture choices, cause I couldn't maintain things or put out fires during the day. So, what was good about that is I got a lot of experience that I think people now are not getting, and why you make certain decisions, why what the trade-offs are, why you don't do certain things that you could do if you're using AI. So I got a good amount of judgment that I think an incumbent wouldn't necessarily have, just because you have training wheels on now. But yeah, in the last, I'd say more so the last year with like Fable and Claude getting much better at agentic coding, I've had a lot of people try to copy what I'm doing. I even have customers who the reason they're a customer is they're trying to reverse engineer it. And I even will like get on calls with people that have told me, I'm building a competing product. I want to learn your secrets. Can you do a call? And I'll just do it for the fun of it. And then try to get them to like, hey, why don't we just like partner and, work together instead of you just like competing. And yeah, so it's hard. And I have colleagues in the industry that have their leading businesses in the same type of niche and focusing on different things that have been overtly ripped off. Like I had a call with a friend last week who was like, yeah, this customer had Fable go through and like reverse engineer from the binary level, like, which is very, very hard to do, and open sourced it. And basically has been trying to cannibalize my business. And I have no legal recourse because he's overseas in some country where like there's no hope of you doing anything about it. So yeah, I think there's this constant threat now that you used to not have. It would take longer for someone to pop up and start doing the same thing when they realized it was profitable. And it's also risky for me to go on and just tell people like, hey, here's this thing that's pretty profitable and I think it's a good business. But I've also learned some things that I think these people miss. And one thing is there's the marketing side to a business. And it's very hard to acquire customers at a profitable price point. And a customer acquisition cost is the thing, customer acquisition and the cost of it is what kills a lot of startups before they even get off the ground. So you have to solve that along with the technical hurdles. And then people actually have to trust you because you're asking them to put like really sensitive stuff on their devices and you don't even have your face on the thing you're building. Or if you do, you don't like have any personal history with it or you don't really care about it. And people can't exactly connect those things. So I'm aware that there's a good bit of ignorance behind copycats, but I'm also aware that there's a segment of my audience that would go to a copycat. And that's okay with me because they're maybe not the customer I want around anyway. If like they're extremely focused on cost and they'll just like go take something that ripped me off and they don't even know who the person is or if the product works. So yeah, I will say it's been a challenging time because of that. But despite all this, my business has been growing and I've been able to ship more because of AI. But I'm constantly dealing with that threat.
Yeah, it's interesting. There are certainly parallels. I mean, it's like a timeless thing, right? In business, like if something is successful, people will try to copy it and whatever, meet market demand. And I do remember, like, with just the online courses that I did, actually, even still, I mean, I put out some course in like 2014, and I get little alerts that people are still trying to share it on whatever the, you know, you could join the websites that have all the courses unlocked. And I'm like, why are you taking a course from like 2014 about link building that is completely irrelevant? I mean, this is nonsense. And I know it's just a weird marketing thing, but all that to say, when I first saw it, it really bothered me in 2014. But then I was like, am I going to try to battle these people or just keep moving? Because those are not customers I want anyway. They could fuck off.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, totally. Yeah.
So, is there anything that you're doing like specifically to account for that? Just from the business perspective or marketing or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, I put a lot of effort into building a marketing asset, which like when I publish content now, there's a very high chance it ranks for what I try to rank for. And I spend a lot of time describing the business across a lot of different content streams so that what AI knows what Tech Lockdown is, it knows what Living Room is, it knows the challenges it's solving for. So when someone searches for really specific things like, how do I prevent my kid from listening to music that I don't approve of, right? Like very niche, like very long tail term. The AI search has been actually helpful in this sense where I'm getting probably 10,000 searches less each month now because of these changes, but my hit rate is higher. I get more people that sign up with less traffic. And I think it's because AI will do a fan out search query based on someone's just garbled, like I just spoke into the microphone and described my problem in a paragraph. It does all these sub queries that are more specific. It compiles it into a summary and you're a lot of times used as a source. So there's that. And there's also YouTube content where that's indexed on Google now. These transcripts for these videos is used as a source in a lot of these searches. So you can, like, it's a good idea to use other mediums here. And I realized a lot of competitors like weren't willing to make videos that were actually helpful. And so that's an advantage I have as well, is like I make videos, they get indexed on Google. People, almost every customer I talk to is mentioning a YouTube video. Something that they saw or some article they read. So inbound's a big focus. I don't pay for ads because I've never figured that out. I don't know if you ever figured out ads, but I just burn money with it.
Yeah. Never quite worked out for me either. As we're wrapping up, like I said, we won't end up covering everything, but we're going to actually do a second episode where we're going to talk personal finance stuff, so people could check that out. It'll come out next week. But one thing I was going to ask is, have you thought about selling or setting things up so that you can sell? I mean, what'd you say? You're at MRR of 20K. You could probably sell it for a pretty nice chunk. You may have to stick around for 6 months or whatever kind of deal to transition it. But is that something that you have thought about?
Yeah, actually, I had a company, a competitor actually approached me about buying me out earlier this year, actually, because he realized the marketing asset that I have with the business and that he could really throw it at his products. So yeah, I mean, the offer didn't make sense, like especially from a FIRE perspective. I wasn't going to be able to retire off of something like that. So I think it's important to have cash flow, especially in the volatility with like the job market. And I would be an idiot to sell something that I either couldn't retire off of or would require me to look for a job in 5 years when I don't know what the market's going to look like. I have thought about it, and there's other things I would want to work on. Like, I probably wouldn't just like go sit on a beach somewhere. But yeah, I'm not sure if people are in the mode to acquire things as much now, because the mindset is that I could just build the same thing. So I don't know if I'll ever get an acquisition offer again, like the one I got this year.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's very interesting. And it would be, I mean, it's the perfect like strategic acquisition where like they have something running. Maybe they have figured out ads, and then they could like layer on your organic growth and like low acquisition cost and all that stuff. Anyway, always interesting, especially like as I look back, it's like I always should have sold anything sooner. And then I observed friends where it was like, yeah, it was always too late, but different financial goals and constraints overall. Last thing, you mentioned in another interview that I listened to over on the Niche Pursuits podcast, you mentioned that you started with YouTube, you did a few videos, and then you kind of like took a break a little bit. I mean, YouTube can be challenging from the motivation standpoint, from, you know, what content you're going to cover that fits the marketing funnel. So are you going to like keep doing the same video like every week or something, or are you going to like build a bigger funnel? But like, where are you now with YouTube? Like you said, it seems to be a very good channel to bring in the right people that do convert into customers.
Yeah, I've tried to make YouTube work. Like the first probably 5 or so, maybe 6 videos got like, you know, a couple 100,000 views across all of them. And the more recent ones I've made, like, you know, a good one might get 3,000 views, something like that. And then another one might get like 300. It just varies. And I don't really, there's all kinds of problems I have with YouTube where like the audience is kind of split. You have parents that want solutions, and then you have adults that want solutions for themselves. And I'm kind of talking to almost 2 audiences, which is, you're not really supposed to do that with YouTube. Like, I'm no expert. I just read some stuff that was like, have this one way that you do things and talk to like one segment. Don't try to talk to everybody. But I've discovered that, yeah, I'm probably not a great YouTuber, but the thing that I think I do well with YouTube is I make things that people search for and they find. So my analytics basically show that if anyone watches the video, it's because they found it in search on YouTube or on Google. And the video, like, it's helpful. It like walks someone through how to solve a problem. And then it usually, like, I pin a comment that links to something relevant, like a resource. So I would have like a written guide for the video that I link to. People go to that and they see CTAs for related stuff, right? So I've tried to really, like, I can't be a YouTube influencer. I've realized that. I can like make YouTube videos, but I'm just not an influencer, and I won't have like, I don't have that gifting, I guess. I'd love it if I could hire someone to do that. But what I realized is that as the founder, you are really the best person to sell a lot of the time, or it has to be someone with equity. It can't just be like someone you're paying on a contract. So I haven't cracked the code, but I have gotten a lot out of YouTube.
Yeah. It's an interesting, you know, medium overall. But I think you're looking at it in a healthy way. 'Cause like, if people really get into it, it gets weird, you know? So, okay. We'll wrap this one up. I think we got through a good chunk of it. Hopefully, I mean, I think the story is really, you know, fun to hear about, and then the challenges along the way. Ben, where can people find you if they want to follow along, check out some of the stuff you're working on?
So the thing I'm spending most of my time on is techlockdown.com. And that's the device management, DNS filtering, all the stuff for locking down devices. I have a Twitter, but I don't, or X account, but I don't post on it. So I'm not even going to mention it. And there's livingroomapp.com, which is the iPhone and iPad app that parents use to monitor their devices. Surprisingly, adults use it for like an accountability app that's really strict. But those two things are like my bread and butter. That's what I'm spending all my time on right now. And if you want to email me, you can contact me through one of those websites, and I'm happy to talk to anyone that emails.
Very good. Thanks a lot. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Doug. This was fun.